extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Welcome, everybody, to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tires, Club and Country Edition. It's World Cup qualifying day. Of course, USMNT fans, you are angry. We are here for you. First time, really. This is CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. Canadian fans, three games on the road, 3 points in World Cup qualifying. Congratulations to Canada. We are going to hit all of that over the next hour or so. Also, MLS this weekend, so we're going to hit that at the end of the show for all of you watching live and listening on the podcast. I, of course, am David Goss here in the AT&T 5G virtual studios and some basement somewhere in the United States of America. I am joined by Kaylin Carr and Matt Doyle because Andrew Wiebe is doing something unimportant tonight. I think it's his wedding anniversary. I'm not sure. Either way, not more important than 75 ball boys on the field at the end of World Cup qualifying to take down the United States for Panama 1-0. Annabelle Godoy credited with the goal. I don't know. Giassi's artist might have a little bit of a complaint about that, but not really. In the end, normally we go one-word answer. Doyle, throw that out the window. Give me your visceral, your deep initial reaction to this USMNT game.
I mean, it just made me go dead inside watching them be this listless and like everything that worked the other day kind of disappeared. All the talk about verticality and, you know, getting forward at pace and sending multiple runners and, you know, coordinated runs. None of that was to be found. And you can't. Not, I mean, if you do that, that's how you end up with zero shots on target and only 5 shots overall. And on top of that, the listlessness kind of, well, I mean, more than kind of, it very much seeped over into just competing for the ball at midfield. Like the U.S. dominated Jamaica in duels the other day. Anytime there was a loose ball, the U.S. was coming away with it. It was the other way around tonight. If you go on the road and that's how you play, you're lucky to only win 1-0. I think the U.S.
lose?
Oh, 1-0? I mean, yeah, sorry. You're lucky to only lose 1-0. I think the U.S., I mean, the only reason it was that close is because Walker Zimmerman, I thought it had a great game, and he's pretty much the only one. And it was really dispiriting to see this team that felt like had made so much progress over the past 180 minutes regress to, you know, really the worst that we've seen from them.
Kaylin, how's that make you feel?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it was completely flat. That was my main complaint. It just seemed slow, second to every ball, a lack of competition, a lack of competing for second balls. And just, I think just overall, a lack of confidence. Every single player on the team seemed to kind of shy away from the moment, bar for maybe Tyler Adams, Brendan Aaronson, you saw him come in, give some energy maybe in the second half. But it just, it seemed to, as the U.S. seemed to lose that confidence and it seemed to kind of drop for it. Every player to a man, even to Matt Turner, who looked shaky on some crosses that we generally see him handle, and some of his just distribution as well. It seemed to give Panama and the crowd that confidence where they kind of continued to grow into the game, and then they started knocking it. And you see from there, generally in the second half, we've seen the U.S. be able to really kind of grow into the game and maybe even change it. But yeah. I think at this point it was a little bit too little too late where, yes, those changes came in and helped to an extent, I think, like Tyler and Brendan specifically. But it just really didn't end up ever really turning into gilt-edged opportunities or even a really good one. I think we had no shots on goal from my count. One, the most dangerous shot was right when Pepe came in and DeAndre Yedlin was on the ground and he was able to kind of get a broken play where he hits one to the back post. But other than that, there really wasn't much going forward in the attack for the U.S. team. And I think some of those questions will come down to, were there too many changes? Because generally when you see that lack of continuity or confidence and disjointedness, it comes down to how many changes, 7 were made. And for me, it wasn't just that there were 7 changes. It was really, I think it revealed a little bit of a lack of the depth right now where we thought we were maybe a little bit further along as far as players that could come into a tough environment and get opportunities. And then I think also a lack of relationships as far as where those changes were made, because you see some guys come in and it's one thing to make one change here or there, but almost there were no partnerships, and you could see that in the team's play.
I love the idea that Kalen's got the old school scoreboard, just keeping shots and shots on goal.
It's like a baseball,
in his apartment. Nathan Bailey tweeted. Nathan Bailey tweeted something similar at us, Doyle, which was, it feels like we weren't set up to get a result here with the lineup that was put out there, that we were set up to fail. Kalen mentioned the changes, but I would argue the two field players outside of Walker Zimmerman, who maintained from the last game, they looked exhausted in the first half, in Yunus Musah and Paul Areola. And you talk about depth. I mean, at some point, Greg Berhalter's hands are tied, or do you put this on him for the way this team went out and performed?
No, I mean, obviously he made some of the wrong calls with how much he rotated and who he rotated. I maintain that the home games are more important. So I completely understand keeping Tyler Adams fresh, trying to anyway. I completely understand keeping Miles Robinson, Anthony Robinson as well, Serginho Dest. I completely understand all of that. What I don't understand is how Kellen Acosta and Sebastian Legette, a few other guys, Jossie Zardes wasn't great, Tim Weah, all these guys who have played so well. Kellen Acosta was the man of the match in the Gold Cup final against Mexico. He was the best player on the field. Playing as a number six, and he finally got a chance to play number six in qualifying tonight. He looked afraid of the ball. He looked afraid of the moment. And this is a guy who's played in qualifiers before. Kellen Acosta's played in the Azteca in a qualifier before. He's had big moments for club and country in Central America before. So it was really disheartening to see these guys who all summer long were making a case for being the type of depth that would get the U.S. through qualifying with, I don't want to say ease, but with few moments like this one, really shy away from it. It was that first half, and especially was tough to watch. Obviously, Tyler Adams bumped it up a level in the second half, but even that was not. It was still not good. And the guys we've seen repeatedly throughout this year, guys given a chance to step up in the moment and win a job and do it. It was the opposite of that tonight. It was guys like playing so poorly that you have to lose confidence in them after this performance.
So we did this show after the Gold Cup final. We celebrated that the big mystery this summer was who can replace Tyler Adams.
Yeah.
And we came away with Kellen Acosta. Is it the role? Can he not play that role? Is he really an eight? Does he need to be in there with Tyler?
He's been better as a six for the U.S. than he's ever been as an eight. Because as an eight, he doesn't get on the ball and drive forward. He doesn't do the stuff that we saw Yunus Musah do the other night.
But he didn't do it as a six today either.
I know. But we have seen him do that, though. Right? We saw him do that against Mexico, against Qatar. Those teams are better than Panama. We saw him do that. Why he wasn't able to do it tonight, I mean, he's got to ask himself that. And Greg Berhalter's got to figure it out too. Because when basically the whole team comes out flat, something has gone wrong with the coaching and the game plan and the preparation. And it feels like that was very much the case. It's the 4-year anniversary of Kuva. It feels like a little mini celebration of the Kuva anniversary, because it was very similar to how the U.S. played in that game, where they kind of just walked down the field and expected to walk away with a result. And that's never good enough. It's never good enough in World Cup qualifying. You have to put something into it. And these guys pretty much looked afraid to.
To be clear, the Sanzuzzi moment, of course, happened at the Estadio Romel Fernandez in Panama City, the U.S. beating Panama, keeping them out of the 2014 World Cup. That is the only game Panama has lost at home in this final round of World Cup qualifying ever. So this isn't a place where people go get points. Mexico got a point. They trailed in that game as well, and they struggled in the last window. So this isn't an easy game. This isn't an easy performance. Kalen, we have a question or a comment in the YouTube. And it basically says Greg talks about verticality a lot, and it feels like Sebastian Legette passes back every single time he touches the ball. Where is the disconnect here between what we've saw against Jamaica, what we hear Greg Berhalter talking about all the time, and then what we saw out on the field.
Well, I think, you know, when we were talking about players that were missing or absent and guys that you can't really go without right now, I do think that Tyler Adams is one of those guys. And if you're going to make a bet, I know Doyle was talking about having to make that sort of difficult bet as to say, do you want to use him at road or at home, or how do you get the most out of him? I think it was difficult without him in the midfield, and that's not a knock on Acosta, who I think actually has earned the trust that he's gotten in this team based on his performances so far, and didn't have a great night. But I do think that when you're searching for a little bit of personality and you've lost, you know, no Weston, no Gio, no Christian, you go down the roster a little bit.
No Steph.
Yeah, it's. Tyler's a guy you want to see from the start. And it starts to ask questions of why the U.S. national team, if you go back, I think, what is it, 7 matches haven't scored a goal in the first half. And it's saying, how do you maybe make a bet where you say, I may not be able to use this player for the full match, but how do you come out with a better attitude, a better starting position for the team to give them a chance? And then maybe you make some changes where I think we were pretty happy with saying, okay, Pepe, he's done a lot, but he maybe can't go from the start in this one. Or so you maybe bring him on. But I do think Tyler is one where you felt like you missed it. And the same thing, I think Brendan, honestly, he in the last window started the first match and we thought, oh, maybe he can't go again because he put so much into it. But he would have been another name, I think, over Areola, where I would have liked to see him. I just feel like when you go down the level and you're missing some of your top players, those two have sort of solidified themselves to me as our next two kind of like big time guys that are showing up right now. And that continuity and that confidence was missing. And just those little moments where we got the ball actually in a few times in good positions in the attack, but Areola's touch let him down, or Jossie's touch let him down, where they had to take an extra one and then weren't able to spring the guy in behind. And I feel like Brendan has been able to show in those moments that he can kind of find that pass or find that little space. We put ourselves in a little bit of a hole. And then also just disappointing to lose on a set piece anytime, especially with the U.S. Team that we have. And, you know, we had Zimmerman out there and they just looked, we used the word flat to begin with, but even on the defending of that set piece, we looked flat footed. And it just didn't seem like, you know, there were some warning signs early in the match and guys didn't respond, to get the clearance out and let Godoy get ahead on it first.
Warning signs that. Panama tried an Olympico on back-to-back plays and almost scored on both of them. And I don't know if there's video out there on Matt Turner that shows that he's susceptible to this, because there's nothing in the U.S. shape that, you know, in defending a set piece that really makes sense of why you'd attempt that, Doyle. And then on the actual goal, Godoy wins the first header. And no one even challenges him. And what? Sorry, Caleb.
No, I think it's a little bit less of saying that they saw a weakness in Matt Turner specifically than saying you're probably not going to isolate your players and say that against the U.S. you're going to be able to create a mismatch one-on-one that you're going to be able to take advantage of. So instead, you kind of just throw it in the mix, get physical in the box, try and mix it up, and hopefully you get a deflection or an own goal or something like that, which ended up working for them.
For what it's worth, I don't think the first one was an Olympico attempt. I think Turner just kind of flailed at that first one and got a little bit lucky, and he actually got a touch to it. And then, so then what was it, Barsanis who was taking the corner? So Barsanis he just had a heat check on the second one just to see, which, you know, why not? That kind of tells a story in and of itself. Like the Panamanian players were locked in. They were alive and awake to the moment. And when opportunities were presenting themselves, they were on the balls of their feet, you know, ready to try to take advantage. And the U.S. were just so passive throughout the night. And that includes into second half stoppage. There were 2 minutes into second half stoppage. The U.S. has the ball upfield, you know, and there's Panama clears it to midfield and Tyler Adams has a nice little header backwards towards where DeAndre Yedlin is, shaded towards the sideline, maybe a little bit more than he wanted. But Yedlin was just standing there flat footed, not reading the play at all. And instead of keeping possession, because he was a beat too slow, instead of keeping possession, getting the ball downfield and running it through again, Walker Zimmerman's out there as your center forward, you know, Ricardo Pepe's playing off him. Instead of having that, the ball just trickles out of bounds. And that's DeAndre Yedlin, who's played in a World Cup, who's played in multiple qualifiers, throughout the Americas, throughout North America. So it was, for whatever reason, that kind of night for the U.S. And there were very few players who were immune to it. And as a fan, that frustrates me. I mean, certainly, I'm afraid to look in the YouTube comments right now. I assume it's an absolute bloodbath. But as a coach, Greg Berhalter has got 2 days to figure this out and to make sure that at home against Costa Rica, the U.S. comes out on the front foot. Now, hopefully, having Tyler Adams from the start, having Weston McKennie hopefully from the start, having Yunus Musah, I guess, kind of somewhat rested, getting that midfield back will help. But this is such a bad data point to have about the ability of the guys down the depth chart to be trusted in a big moment. You need more than 11 guys to qualify for the World Cup. And this was not a great night for the U.S. fan, for U.S. coaching staff or fans to think, yeah, we got that. We got more than that.
And what stands out to me, and this is just one of those little moments, is in the behind the crest that U.S. soccer puts out after each game, they showed the meeting when all the players came for the first time before the Jamaica game. And Greg Berhalter said, we're going to watch some video, blah, blah, blah. And he said, what we now know, that the number one thing that wins in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying is intensity. And if we don't have more intensity, we won't win. That was his comment. That's what he said to the team coming into this camp, trying to fix things from last time, in saying, we have ideas, we have things we need to work on in terms of tactics and soccer and all of that. But the number one thing to win in this region is intensity. And then you go out in Panama and you don't have it. And you talk about depth and quality and touches and all those things. But if they had that, you probably battle out to 0-0 draw. And we're going to talk about Canada in 5-10 minutes. And that's what they were able to do.
So it shows in duels, right? It, against Jamaica the other day, the U.S. won 63 duels. And Jamaica won 29, which is absurd. You beat a team 2-1 in 50-50s. You're going to win that game. Tonight, it was Panama 46-38. And it was more lopsided than that until about the last 10 or 15 minutes of the game. Not every duel is made the same way. It's not a perfect stat, but I do think it's a pretty fair reflection of the intensity battle, and the U.S. lost it. The U.S. absolutely lost it. And, they lost it with guys who, a lot of them have been there before and were supposed to be kind of the steady hands who get you through these moments, and they weren't. And that's something that Berhalter is going to have to he's going to have to figure it out. Yeah. The U.S. has to figure this out, because this was a bad beat.
Wednesday night, that one against Costa Rica. Costa Rica trailed 1-0 at home to El Salvador. They came back and won that game 2-1 in the second half. Costa Rica,
behind the legends, Brian Ruiz and Kelso Borges, man.
Borges scored the goal?
Yeah, I think he got the second one, right?
I didn't know. I thought Moya may have scored. Whatever it is, they've got their own things to deal with. Kalen, people want us to pick into a couple individual performances. My question for you is, I think in the Jamaica game, Dest and Anthony Robinson, were huge and obviously created the two goals that ended up happening. What did you make of what you saw from Bello and Shaq Moore or Yedlin as well at those fullback spots?
Well, you understand, I was, while Dest, I think, got forward in the first match and, had the nice assist and was able to show his quality, I don't think this was a game that was really going to be, he was going to be well suited for. So you understand making the change. I anticipated that change to be DeAndre Yedlin based on his performance just kind of over time and just his experience level to be able to step into a match like that and to compete. Although when you look back at the first match, Shaq Moore was the substitute. And so I think that was maybe a little bit of a hat tip from Greg that he was going to be the one to get some minutes and come in. On the other side, George Bello, I think, is a good player, but it was just difficult because he's also playing with a center back right next to him that hadn't played the last match. And this goes back to what I was saying before, as far as trying to find partnerships, because yes, you can find good players. And I think all these players are good players. But I think it's very difficult to step into a match in where there is no continuity or no partnerships. The same thing I would say with Timothy Weah, where I thought he came in, made an instant impact off the bench in the last match. But it's different to step into the match and say, okay, well, I've got Weston here, and then I've got Anthony Robinson bombing up around me. And I understand, kind of similar to when I came in the last match, what this might look like, as opposed to the few helpful balls that Walker Zimmerman's going to try and play diagonally to me, or even understanding defensively the assignment where he had to track back sometimes where he wasn't maybe expecting to, and they were able to create some overloads and on both sides with the outside backs. So I think that lack of partnerships was really difficult. So when you change, to me, when you change both outside backs, you can't change one of the center backs. I think you have to keep, and there are certain guys I think at this roster where Miles Robinson, I would count as one of them. And I don't have, I'm not privy to the conversations they've had about where they're at physically, but if you can tell me that Robinson, and it's no disrespect to the center backs that are out there, but for me, if you can keep to your two center back pairings at all and they have any continuity, you try and do that. I would say same thing where Yunus Musah, if you can play him with Adams, where they played in the first match, maybe you get something a little bit more out of Musah in that one. Or even when you look at the wingers and the striker position, just to create some type of partnerships. And I think on the wing play in specifically, they never saw any kind of real relationship forming between the wingers and the outside backs. And then I would even add between the outside backs and the center backs. So it just looked kind of disconnected.
I agree with you, it was disconnected, but I'm going to push back on that, because the one thing we saw from the first phase of games is that teams that didn't rotate got annihilated in the third game, including and especially Honduras, obviously, but Mexico struggled in that third game because Tata didn't really rotate a bunch.
Rotated today. Well, and not he, the front yeah. line, but everyone.
So, like, I get what you're saying, Kalen, and like, you know, part of me agrees with you, but the other thing to remember is that this is a less important game. It's more important to have Miles Robinson and Tyler Adams and, you know, Anthony and Robinson and Serginho Dest healthy and ready and good to go for the home game. Because if you win your home games, you will make the World Cup.
Yeah. I'm just saying where you do it. I had no problem with changing the outside backs. In fact, you had to make one change, obviously. And then I think Dest as well. And then you look at, I'm just saying, if you can keep that spine, as much as you can keep that spine of the team intact, then you can maybe make some changes on the outsides and it might not look so drastic. So that was, right. I understand the need for changes. I just thought the amount of them and maybe the specific places on the pitch where they came.
I will say outside. the weird thing is that he took Pepe and Aaronson out with 25 minutes left against Jamaica the other day. And I thought that was a signal that these guys were going to start in the second game. And it was weird that they got the rest, but then they didn't get the start. And at the same time, Areola started, and you know, Areola emptied his tank against Jamaica. He clearly didn't have any burst in this game tonight. I will agree with you that the rotations were strange. But the cold comfort I will take from it is that I think most of our best players, most of the US's best players are going to be pretty well rested for the game against Costa Rica on Wednesday.
So, Doyle, you just alluded to it a little, but get a tie on the road. That's a win, you know, win your home game. So for the US, you only miss out on 1 point here.
It's about points denied. It's about points denied to Panama. That's the big one.
So Panama was sitting in fourth. It looked like a gap was going to open up. Now Panama's tied with the US in second or third, however you want to do it. And so that I understand that. We have a comment here from YouTube. It says it's not about rotation, but who you choose to rotate, which I think goes to Kalen's point of trying to manage this roster over the course of this. Now, I think we had a bunch of people just open up the comment section with protect Greg Berhalter. We dare you right now, which is ridiculous in its own right. But you're missing. You came into the camp missing Gio Reyna, Christian Pulisic, Jonathan Brooks, and Tim Ream. Then you lose Weston McKennie. And you lose Anthony Robinson for this game. As Kalen mentioned, you're not going to play Dest as well. You are fairly far down the line for Greg Berhalter to even have that many decisions to make as you go through this. That's my personal opinion. But I want to ask you, Joy, how big of a hit is this to World Cup qualifying?
It's big, but I mean, it's a long... You know, the U.S. ends the night in second place, I think, still, right? And then, they've played three of the five games on the road. So if they win on Wednesday, they will be no worse than second place after six games in the Ocho. It's a big if, right? Learn that, you know, have learned that lesson multiple times now throughout qualifying. It's nothing is given. They have to go out there and earn it. But like, it, you know, it wasn't a great night for Greg Berhalter. That said, I put this one much more on the players.
Yeah.
Like Kellen Acosta had to play better than he did. Sebastian Legette had to play better than he did. Tim Weah, both fullbacks, Mark McKenzie just completely lost out there.
Can I close out on this one? Because we're going to move to Canada in a second. Kalen, Giassi Zardes. Mm-hmm. As I crawl through the Twitter mentions and the negativity that exists out there, he gets the start. Does he get a chance to get more starts in your mind? How much of this do you put at his feet?
He will definitely get more starts. Until somebody else comes up to claim, I guess, you know, anything close to the number two position right now, I don't see any reason why he shouldn't. And that's not to say that he had a good performance. In fact, I don't think he had a great performance tonight. But I think right now, when we look at the depth chart, you're saying, okay, well, who's coming in besides Pepe right now? And right, Pepe had to rest, or they decided to rest him and came in. The only thing I'll say is we did not, the other disappointing part to me was that we didn't create anything late on in the game. And part of it was there were multiple balls coming onto the pitch. Players were going down. There was the head injury.
Usually we're at our strongest in the multi-ball phase. You know, that's when the U.S. has traditionally been the best.
But we just didn't create any opportunities. And even when you remember the sort of historic performances at Canada against Panama that have managed us to keep that perfect record, where this was our first loss ever, where you either with the Sanzuzi goal or I think Dempsey had one before late on, where it just takes a little bit of that extra energy or fight. And that was part of the piece that I think we began with that also we finished with too, that just wasn't there tonight at the very end of the match. So just not even been able to create an opportunity to give ourselves a chance late on was disappointing. And, you know, if you want to be critical of the substitutions, I will say, you know, Matthew Hoppe was maybe a roll of the dice where you're kind of want to take a look at, and you say, well, this guy is one thing we've known is he can come on late in the match. We've seen him this summer come in and get an important equalizer for us in the Nations League, or sorry, in the Gold Cup. And he's just the type of player that kind of has exactly what you're looking, what the match was searching for a little bit. And instead we kind of put Walker Zimmerman up as a second striker. I would have been interested to see, you know, we have a guy who plays, who is desperate to convince you he's a number nine. Well, why don't we give him an opportunity maybe in this match where you're down a goal late on in the second half and you need to get a point on the road and you don't necessarily have a plan on saving him, obviously, or likely starting him for the next match. So that would have been sort of one criticism I would have as far as the substitution choices. If you are going to roll the dice and you don't have a shot on goal, why not look down the bench and see a guy like Matthew Hoppe is, you know, desperate to get into the match and try and make something happen.
But Kalen, Anibal Godoy scores. And Greg Berhalter sitting there saying, if the second best goal scorer in Nashville gets a goal, then we need last year's Golden Boot winner, Walker Zimmerman, around the goal to create chances for us. And Gary Smith's on the phone being like, mate, just do it.
It's something they've tried before. I mean, they played Miles Robinson up there late on in matches, I remember, in the Gold Cup or Nations League. I can't remember which one. So it is a tactical wrinkle that they've tried in the past that I don't really have a problem with. I just couldn't help but think about at the time, oh man, this game needs some energy. It needs some life. You know, who could help? And, but you know, overall, I just thought same thing. The performance from the team tonight was not good enough, but good thing is you get a couple days just to get back after it and, you know, try and turn it right.
Lower.com field, the new legacy in Columbus for World Cup qualifying. Of course, historic Crew Stadium is the, spiritual home of U.S. World Cup qualifying success in the past until Jurgen Klinsmann broke that, which thanks, Jurgen. Appreciate that one as well. And we're hoping the U.S. is able to move on and do a little bit better. Costa Rica coming in, as we said, off that 2-1 win. It's been a slog for them in World Cup qualifying. It's just been in general right now for that national team trying to get through it. Is there anything big anyone wants to talk about before we move to Canada?
No, let's move to Canada.
All right, Canada. A slow, plodding, less intense, tough performance, but they drew. So everything worked out. This was a big day for Canada, obviously coming off the Mexico performance, Doyle, that we came onto the show and we talked about the spirit they played with, the confidence they played with, the decisions John Herdman made, the fact that Canada is the first team in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying history to take a point both on the road at Mexico and at the U.S. in the final round of World Cup qualifying. Mm-hmm. And then they go to Jamaica and they get a 0-0 tie with a slightly rotated team. What did you make of John Herdman's decisions on this second day compared to Greg Berhalter and then the performance you saw?
A point on the road is almost always good, right? And this is Canada we're talking about. They haven't made the World Cup since the Reagan administration. So I don't want to hold them to too high a standard here. But at the same time, maybe a little disappointed. Like, this Panama team went to the office, went to Jamaica, and won 3-0. We saw Canada draw at the U.S. We saw Canada draw at the Azteca. Like, going to Jamaica, and this is no disrespect to the Reggae Boys, but they're a team in flux right now. Like,
they started
me,
Alvis Powell at center back.
Sorry, it was Alvis Powell. Alvis Powell and Mariapa at center back, and then O'Neill Fisher at right back. Like,
to be clear, what we mean by this is a team in flux.
Like, that is a team that I expected Canada's attack to find goals against, and I am a little surprised that they didn't. Now, they have had a very tough schedule, relatively speaking, throughout this early part of the hex. They have gotten points in every road game so far. They're in fourth place right now. They'll finish the night in fourth place. I don't think this is a crisis. I don't think alarms are ringing, but to me, this feels for Canada sort of the same way the scoreless draw at El Salvador felt for the U.S. Like, maybe not your best performance, and a point on the road is okay, but also, like, you should have had three.
And you start to worry about that, like you said, with Panama, there are points that other people are getting. So where does that leave Canada down the road? You drop points at home to Honduras, which right now, losing to Mexico 2-0, they lost at home to the U.S. That doesn't feel like one of the teams that's going to be a power over the course of this World Cup qualifying. And then you look at Jamaica, who, as we have said, have had their struggles that Canada can't get the win over. But Kalen, at the same time, a point is somewhat of a victory. Coming out of the emotional experience at Azteca, would you have expected anything different? Like, were we hopeful?
I think you were hopeful, and there was reason to be. I think, to Doyle's points, that you felt that this Canada team, in fact, coming off the emotional lift of going to the Azteca and getting a point, would then go on and be able to not just get a point on the road, but to take three. And I think we saw with the U.S. team as well, we had felt that same type of energy, and people who had maybe began the week saying, yeah, seven's cool, like, are kind of like, oh, nine, I don't know, I feel like we might be able to do this. And that's the danger of CONCACAF, right? That's the danger, that you go on and you think, well, if this happened here, then, you know, that's going to correlate to this in the next match there. And we've come to realize time and time again that that's just not how this works, because, like you said, the players that you even mentioned, you know, guys that, like, who you would think in Major League Soccer play are not necessarily world beaters or on teams that aren't even in the playoffs. When you play for your country, it's a different thing altogether. And that experience of playing in these matches, and a lot of these guys have played in a ton of them, going against teams that have not played in as many or younger talented players for the U.S. and Canada, that maybe don't have that same sort of sweat equity that you would have if you play for a Panama, 50 to 70 times or 100 times or whatever it might be.
Is sweat equity an old Houston Dynamo term? That feels like a Dom Kinnear term right there.
It does. I was going to say about Manor Figueroa, but he got a red card earlier against Mexico. But you just see these guys, they lift, they, you know, they sort of lift their performances in matches like this, and you can play them out of position. You can pull them off the scrap heap and whatever it might be. And they'll give you a tough match. And, you know, if you gave me the option of going back in time and saying, all right, don't be greedy. Just take the, would you take the point in Panama? Absolutely. You'd say yes right now. And U.S. men's soccer Twitter would still be going nuts at that point. I think the reason to go crazy right now is because of the performance, and tied to the result. And those two obviously are inextricable, but I think the idea that the U.S., the most disappointing part to me was that the U.S. team didn't fight. And on a bad day, we've seen before in bad days for the U.S. team, them maybe not having their best day, but the fight has not been something you've questioned with them.
But I thought you were about to say Canada.
Yeah, we're on the Canada segment. Yeah,
you were rolling about Canada, and then all of a sudden you lost me there at the last second.
But the Canada, it's more the context.
The love of Andre, no, come on, man.
The context is just saying that the Canada team, you know, they maybe didn't have their best performance, but they didn't let anybody down. And a point on the road is not three, but obviously, but, you know, I think it's, yeah, as long as they've shown they can do well on the road.
So for Canada, Steven Vitoria and Tayshaun Buchanan, they were suspended on yellow card accumulation. So that's already two big hits to what would be a starting lineup and maybe something John Herdman would have rotated anyway. We see Steven Eustachio move to the bench for this one. Sam Piette gets the start alongside Mark Anthony Kay, and then Richie Laiye as well comes out of the starting lineup. Sam Adekube comes in. And then Daniel Henry and Derek Cornelius, making sure that Mark DeSantos put this team in a good place as he moves on, or whatever term he used.
So just to the point that we were making before about rotating, this is Canada. This is John Herdman rotating both center backs, rotating his D mid, rotating one of the fullbacks. So I think for, you know, and they went on the road and they pitched a shutout. Now, granted, they didn't attack as well as they should have, but like I thought that
Jamaica
that
hit Daniel the post Henry, twice as well.
No, there you go. But I thought Daniel Henry and Derek Cornelius were going to struggle badly with Shamar Nicholson and Bobby Reed and the rest of that attack. But it can be done. Rotation in these three game windows, and there's one more three game window coming up. The January February one is three games. You've got to be able to do it, man. You've got to be able to go down that bench and find answers, because to ask these guys to come from club teams where they're playing 90 minutes every week, and then play three games in 7 days, 270 minutes, and then send them back to play more on their weekend. I mean, Tyler Adams got a muscle injury literally right after he got back to Leipzig after the previous window. So it's, you know, the managers have to weigh these kind of things. You know, I'm not sure either Berhalter and or Herdman got it right tonight. I'm not sure either of them got it wrong. At some point, the players have to be accountable,
which I think is fair. I also think for Herdman, we're not going to know until 3 days, right? If he's able to put the right team out there on Wednesday night, because Vitoria and Miller, or at least Miller, got the rest. Because I thought maybe you start Kamal Miller in this one. Vitoria suspended. Play him with one of Henry or Cornelius. You have that experience out there, and then reverse it for the final game. I thought that would have made sense, but you know, if Herdman gets 3 points there, then it doesn't matter, and then it's job well done.
And to be clear, that game is at BMO Field, I believe.
Yeah,
against this Panama side, which is basically not rotated at all through five games. So I expect Panama to be completely out of gas. Like, that is a pure must-win game for Canada on Wednesday night.
Do you think Davies gets the start? He's now played. He started and went the distance. He hasn't gone the distance in either, I don't think, but he's played 70-plus minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're taking him out of these games for the final 20 minutes, then you're kind of saying that we expect him to play all three. And he's got to, because it is a must-win game. It is a must-win home World Cup qualifier. You got to get your best player out there. And
to be clear, he played the full 90 today, 70 against Mexico.
Okay, so I mean, send the folks at Munich a fruit basket and say sorry. we had to do what we had to do. We need 5 points this window, and if they come away with 5 points, they should be very happy. But yeah, I think you absolutely roll Alphonso Davies out there.
What Canada should do is send a fruit basket for every title that Byron has won since 1986 when Canada was last in a World Cup and be like, look at all you've accomplished. Please let us have this one thing that means so much to us. The big thing that stood out to me in this game from watching Canada, and obviously double screens, not the easiest thing in the world, but talking with some Canadian friends as well, and we kind of have all felt this, is the absence of Jonathan David. And he just is not a game changer right now for this Canada team. And to me, it's not even scoring. It's how dangerous can you make yourself? And it feels like he's playing in third gear a lot of the times. And a lot of times he gets the ball, he's fairly isolated. He doesn't take players on. In the moment Alvis Powell got injured, Alvis Powell chases him over to the right side. He's one-on-one, and he allows Powell to knock the ball away and then goes down. And if he tries to take him on, you're going against an injured defender, and you don't know that. But be aggressive, be dangerous, try and create moments. And Jonathan David hasn't been that. And for Lille, he doesn't have to be that all the time, but he is. Sometimes he drops in and picks up the ball and charges that defender.
Yeah, I mean, but he's a type of guy who's like drifts around and finds the ball a little bit and finds the play. And like when you're asking him to either start or finish combinations around the box, he's really good. But if you need him to be a guy who sets the tempo, who breaks down defenses, he hasn't shown that. He doesn't occupy defenders in the same way that like a Kyle Larin or a Lucas Cavallini do. Like those guys, and I know Larin plays on the left for Besiktas, which is weird, but he's a target forward. He puts his body into defenders and they feel him. And he makes it so that they have to converge on him. And David is kind of a different, he's a different kind of striker. And that's why I think their partnership is so effective. I still think Canada's at the best when they're in a 3-5-2 with both those guys up top, and David can just sort of drift underneath. Asking him to lead the line in these games, you're right. He hasn't been up to it. And kind of feel about him the way I feel about a lot of the U.S. team right now, where it's like it's a little disappointing. And granted, he's younger than most of the guys that I'm super disappointed in from the U.S. side right now. But he's a champion in Ligue 1. You know, he's going to be sold for $50 million somewhere, probably, you know, maybe this winter, probably by next summer. He is a big player. And in these moments, you have to be big, and he hasn't been.
But to Kalen's point about sweat equity in CONCACAF, Carlos Ruiz was never that guy, but he was when he played for Guatemala. Plus Perez wasn't, and he was when he played for Panama. Pavon as well. And then you look at Honduras and Panama making World Cups, and you're talking about guys stepping up and doing more than maybe they're capable of. And I think we've seen it from Alphonso Davies. I think he's done that, and maybe it's not setting tempo. It's not dropping deep and picking up the ball. It's just being aggressive when you're one-on-one with guys. Every once in a while, Liam Miller gets the start in place of Tejon Buchanan. He gets a pretty big opportunity that he makes savable for Andre Blake.
Yep.
You can understand the field's a little choppy, pops up on him. It's a tough ball. This is a kid who doesn't have a ton of first team minutes, starting to get chances in Switzerland. Not a huge opportunity for him, but a little bit tough. Okay, so we come out of these games. Kalen, you get the 2 points on the road for Canada. You get the home win and the obviously away loss for the U.S. Let's start with Canada. What's your feeling about their opportunity? What's your feeling about the group? And what do you see specifically against this Panama team, as Doyle said, that hasn't rotated a lot, that they can do on Wednesday night?
I mean, my genuine feeling about Canada is I've actually been more impressed by them by this window than I was before. And they look to me like a World Cup team. And yeah, tonight wasn't maybe as convincing as you would have liked, but they look to me like a team that is on the road to qualifying because of the way that they've proven already. If you just look at their window, going to Mexico and getting a point, going to the United States and getting a point, that says a lot. Now, the difference is can they continue to hold serve at home? And I think they're capable of doing that. This Panama team put a lot into tonight. They've gotten a massive result that is well-deserved as well. But I think there's going to be it's going to line up well for Canada in the sense that I think Panama is going to be sort of emotionally exhausted and having to kind of recover from that. And I think Canada might actually be a little bit spurred on by saying this wasn't the result that we need. Now we have a little bit more pressure to make sure that we get points at home. So I think that sort of lines up for them well. And then the U.S., it is a gut check moment. And for this young team, they've had a couple of them, and they've generally responded well, and usually in game. Tonight was the first game where I've seen this U.S. team have kind of a shocker of a first half and then not right. come out and sort of redeem themselves. So this is a little bit of a longer window to sit back with that and see how they respond. I feel good that there will be a response. And I do think getting our first choice guys back into the team will make a big difference, mainly because a lot of those guys aren't even necessarily first choice right now because we're missing players due to injury and absences. So getting the group back together in the U.S., and getting back on the right track, I think this team will respond, but disappointing one tonight.
What I expect tactically from Canada, and it comes down to the formation. I think we'll see a return to the 3-5-2 or maybe a 3-4-2-1. Because if you watch the U.S. game, Panama was able to sort of control the U.S.'s distribution. That whole the two center backs and Acosta with just two forwards. Like it was a 4-4-2 from Panama. So if you're Canada, just play, bring Vitoria back in, bring Kamal Miller back in. They're both good passers of the ball. Alistair Johnston as a right center back is a very good passer of the ball. And then you have Eustachio as like, you will shred that 4-4-2. Panama will not be able to control the way Canada progress the ball upfield in the same way that I thought Panama kind of controlled the U.S. So again, the U.S. players have a lot to do with that. As has been said, intensity is the most important thing. And I think if Canada have that and they play just the sort of basic 3-5-2 or 3-4-2-1 that they've played a lot over the course of this year, I do expect that Panama will crumble and the Canadians will put up a good performance. For the U.S., it's Costa Rica. It's going to be a 5-4-1. It's going to be a low block. It's going to be scrappy as hell. I don't know if they're going to play Borges and Ruiz and Joel Campbell and all these guys who have been around for 1,000 years. But like, it doesn't matter how out of gas or how old they all are. Like, they are making every team they face absolutely earn it. And it'll be up to the U.S., and it should be something closer to a first-choice U.S. side. It'll be up to them to not just match the intensity, but to exceed the level of intensity that Costa Rica brings, because it's a six-pointer, man. Like, you've got to win your home games. If you do that, then okay, it's another pretty okay window. If you don't, then it's a step close to something that looks like a crisis.
And it's a pretty okay window. Might be enough over the course of this. Honduras getting beat 3-0 right now by Mexico. It feels like this Costa Rica U.S. game, not just big for the U.S., but for Costa Rica and the entire pool of Costa Rica loses and Canada gets a win or Panama gets a win in the U.S., there starts to be a break between the bottom four and the top four. And obviously the top three are going to auto qualify. The fourth spot is that playoff spot. If the U.S. had held Panama tonight, that break would have happened sooner, but it feels like Panama's going to hold in Costa Rica, trying to find their feet. It's been questionable. As you said, it's a lot of the old heads, Joel Campbell trying to carry them through as they can. So we'll be back, of course. We do pregame on Twitter Spaces right when the lineups drop on Wednesday night. And I think that's a 7 p.m. Eastern time game for the U.S. men's national team. I also think that Anders just showed it below me and I didn't read it. So you probably all know better than I do. That one at lower.com field. If you're in the area, of course, get out there, make some noise, get loud. And then, of course, Canada at home against Panama at BMO field. They just announced they will play Mexico. Canada will at home at in Edmonton. So we don't know if there'll be any more games at BMO. If you're in the Toronto area, they're releasing even more tickets because of COVID restrictions that are being lifted. So get out there and enjoy that one, man.
That'll be November 16th. Yeah. So there'll be a foot and a half of snow on the ground.
I think I got to get there, man. Mexico. I did the research and found out that they played when Sven-Goran Eriksson was Mexico manager. Canada drew Mexico in Edmonton in like November or December. And it was, I think, one of the reasons Sven-Goran Eriksson got fired. So the memories are good. The memories are strong. And That's us for World Cup qualifying right now. Let's move to MLS action. Of course, some players missing for international duty, but many players active. Four games this weekend. No midweek games this week because of World Cup qualifying on Wednesday. And then we'll be back with a full slate of games heading towards the playoffs as we go on. Let's start with the Seattle Sounders. They clinch the playoffs with a 4-1 win over the Vancouver Whitecaps. Anders, I really wish you had given me exact numbers. Is it 13 years in MLS and 13 years in the playoffs? They've made the playoffs every year they've been in MLS. The question is what year the Sounders came in. I know Anders isn't a huge fan, so he probably wasn't at one of the early games or anything like that. And yes, 13 is the answer. 13 is the response. So 13 straight years. And we can dive into this game deep if you want, but Doyle, to me, the first thing that pops up is just pretty much no Nico Lodera all year. You don't have Christian Roldan for a game like this. Rui Diaz has now been out hurt. And they put up four on a Vancouver team that legitimately looks like a playoff contender. And I think had the best run of form coming into this game in the league over the last 10 games it was, except for Seattle.
A little asterisk on that. Vancouver really had to rotate their back line. They're missing some key pieces. And then Thomas Asal, who we all remember from that miraculous game in the MLS back tournament. Yeah. He was in goal for Max Crippo, and he did not cover himself in glory. He did not have that type of but this was...
And fair news, if Will Bruin goes top bins, what are you going to do about it?
This type of win is a – and, like, the way I set that up is Vancouver does not have the type of depth needed to compete in these games where you're missing guys due to injury or international call-up or suspension. And Seattle has the type of depth where you win this game 4-1. Because it wasn't just – you know, Lodero, Rui Diaz, and Christian Roldan. It was Alex Roldan was missing as well. Knew who was gone. There are a couple other. I mean, Jordan Morris hasn't played all year. Brad Smith wasn't on the field for this one. It's just the way this roster is built and the way it's been managed all season long by Brian Schmetzer. Even if the Revs set the single season points record, I'm probably going to vote Schmetzer for coach of the year because it's just been remarkable to watch what's happened with the Seattle team.
Is there any bigger indication than Kellen Rowe bouncing around MLS and no one can get a performance out of him? And now he's a lockdown.
He plays every game, man. Whether it's as an 8 or a 6 or a right wing back, which is where he's played this, like that is, we bang on about club culture and all that, and it's tough to explain sometimes, but you know it when you see it, right? And culture
I think Nicolas Benezé knows it when he sees it too.
Exactly, right? and he brought a little bit of that high class French culture to the celebration after his goal.
I can't do the dance right now.
I think you're exactly right. Look at the who just got in the score sheet: Shane O'Neill, Nicolas Benezé, Will Bruin, and Leo Chu. Right, like those are not headliners as far as and that's no disrespect to them, they're just not the headliners that you generally see the Sounders play, you know, where you watch out, oh, you got to watch out for Morris, you got to watch out for Lodero, you got to watch out for Rui Diaz, all these guys. And it just shows to what a good job they've done to go out and get depth. And Will Bruin, I thought especially, was
awesome in this
game. He was amazing in this match. Did a really, really good job. His hold-up play is fantastic.
A lot of sweat equity. A lot of sweat equity out there on the field.
Exactly. And I thought it was a little bit, but for Vancouver, you know, it was a coming down to earth a little bit because they have been in great run of form. They have been flying. And I think Will Bruin said in the post-game press conference that he was surprised that they played so open with Seattle, and that really sort of played to Seattle's hand. And he's totally right, because I think they thought that they could go toe-to-toe with Seattle. And it shows to me that Seattle can win in a multitude of ways. I still think they're probably a little bit better as a team that makes it difficult, gets behind the ball, builds out, uses the width to get in behind, and then sort of whips good dangerous balls into the box. But if you want to do the end-to-end stuff, they can play that as well. A high-scoring match, they can get rolling, especially at home, and put a bunch on you. I didn't think they were going to get a Brian White got a goal on this one as well for Vancouver, who continues his good run of form. But a little bit naive and maybe a little bit overexcited from Vancouver to try and play, especially with the changes in the back line and a net, to go into a match like that on the road and try and really play them head on.
I think you're right, but I kind of love that they tried it.
That's how they play. Yeah.
In the past, Vancouver would have just, you know, locked it, like put everybody into the box and lost this game 2-0 because they're not actually good at defending on the back foot. So at least they kind of went out on their shield in this one. And I think that is the type of culture that the new interim head coach, Vanni Sartini, is trying to institute there. Like, he wants his team to go out and attack. And sometimes when you do that, you lose 4-1, but I like the fact that they're going to go out and they're going to try to attack next game out too.
And they had some opportunities too. Stephen Fry makes a good save. I think there was one or two chances to home. They should have squared it. Yeah, where you just those little ones where they were dangerous. It's not that they didn't cause the Sounders any problems, but they can definitely turn teams around and trouble them. And Brian White. I was thinking of O'Brien White. That's an old school shout out.
Oh, whoa. UConn legend
right there.
they definitely had some opportunities that could have made this game a lot closer. It could have been, you know, a 4-2 match or, you know, 3-2 certainly at that point in the match. But ultimately, I think the Sounders just had a little too much. Big for them to get Leo Chu as well to get a goal. He seemed to take a lot of confidence from that. It's been dangerous, but it hasn't quite got onto the score sheet. But if they can add that sort of speed option off the bench, and you know, now Benazee as well has proven to be a dangerous player who will likely come off the bench the majority of the time. They've got some weapons and some depth.
What's offensive is they don't even need Leo Chu to win MLS Cup this year, but they might get him. Curveball from Doyle with a Spartan reference. I thought you'd be more of an Athens guy with your philosophy in your armchair analyst. Doyle, last week we said Vancouver has a tough road to get to the playoffs, but we both thought they'd do it. I'm not saying it has to. We don't have to do this every game, but did anything change in your mind?
Is this your way of segueing to the Minnesota United loss to Colorado?
But it can be.
Because that'd
be better than what I was going to do.
That certainly changes things, doesn't it? Like, all year long, I've been saying, Minnesota's not really made for the regular season. They don't have enough depth. Adrian Heath doesn't like to use his subs. But once they get their top guys healthy and available, they'll be fine. And they had most of their top guys healthy and available. It was, you know, Ozzy Alonso and Hassani Dotson deep in midfield. It was, you know, Babelo Reynoso was the 10. Fragapane and Ethan Finley were the wingers. And Adrian Uno was the center forward. Uno, he finally got another goal. They weren't great, but through an hour, they were better, I thought, than the Rapids. And then the Rapids go a man down. And that should have been that. And Minnesota doused themselves in kerosene and lit a match. They lit themselves on fire in this game. And it was one of the worst losses I've seen any team take all year. To have, almost total control of the match, up a goal, up a man in a playoff race, and to come out with nothing is shocking. And it's like alarm bells are sounding now, because Minnesota United in the standings, they're seventh in the standings on 38 points, 1 point ahead of Vancouver. And both teams are even on 28 games played. I did not expect to see that. So, yeah, I kind of think I'm still okay with my pick that the Caps are going to make the playoffs.
Minnesota still has to travel to Vancouver in the third to last game of this season. And their run down the stretch, they have Austin next, but then Philly, LAFC, at Vancouver, and they close home to Sporting Kansas City and on the road against the Galaxy, who will probably be in that scrap as well. So it's not easy. Yeah. It's not easy for this group. I don't want to only talk about Minnesota, though, Kalen. For the Rapids, we thought they I thought that they were going to push for first in the West. That hadn't been the story now over the last 2 months. Dropping points in games they should have gotten them. Dropping from winning positions, dropping at home against teams that are struggling, all those things. Is this one of those moments that maybe helps a team sort of gain confidence and move forward at a higher level?
Oh, I definitely think so. And I think part of it will come due to the fact that I think part of this was a response as well to the match prior, where they went to Seattle and there was a lot of talk about them being close to Seattle or where they fit in the West, and they just got kind of run off the pitch against the Sounders. And I think, you know, came back and you saw the response in this one. No Kellen Acosta, no Mark Anthony Kay, of course, but it didn't much matter. And you know, I know we said we weren't going to talk about Minnesota United, but you know, they've in two other matches they've had a man advantage as well, and in neither game have they taken the full 3 points. So I think it does come.
What is this team?
I think it comes to a little bit of an issue as far as we've talked about in the past, as far as their attack. And when I've looked at Colorado, I've also had the same questions as to how can they get goals. And Barrios gets one in this one. But when you look at statistically throughout their season, they don't give up a lot, which has been good for them. But they have not also been able to get consistent goal scoring production. I think Barrios now is 8 and is their leading scorer. And they have a number of guys on 4 or 5, but it's just not quite been there throughout the season as far as having that reliable threat. But I think this will spur them on. They have, I was looking at their schedule earlier, they do have another match against the Sounders coming up, and they play New England as well. And so they have a couple tough tests left to, but they also have a couple good ones that you feel like they should be able to get on top of. So I do think they will hold on to probably getting a home match in the playoffs. But I think it was really important for them, especially trying to get a response after that last match,
which has to be a victory. You get better than you were last year. Last year, they made the postseason. If they were to host the playoff game, that's that next step under Robin Fraser. And you hope you can continue going forward. Again, they were without Kellen Acosta and Mark Anthony Kay as well for this game. Obviously two huge pieces in their central midfield. Let's move to Saturday night. Some other games, the New York Red Bulls, a 1-0 win, in this one over Inter Miami. The New York Red Bulls, I'm assuming Charlie had something where there was, I don't know, dirt, shovels, boats, whatever analogy he was using.
I missed
that day
the
about
Doyle Grim Reaper. That's who I missed.
That's retired.
Well, would the Grim Reaper be out, though? Because now you look at a New York Red Bulls team, I believe they're 3 points out of the playoffs. The two teams ahead of them on 40 points, Montreal and NYCFC, they play them in the next two games. NYCFC coming up on Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. That's going to be an incredible game.
Is that a home game for the Red Bulls or is that a home game for NYCFC?
Well, I think when you're among friends, Doyle, everyone's a home game. But it's technically a home game for the New York Red Bulls at Red Bull Arena, of course.
Oh, okay.
Doyle, we've talked a lot about the build of this team. So a lot of money spent in unique places. Young foreign players. Drew Yearwood from England, Patrick Lamala now coming over as a young DP, Fabio. It was a unique build in Gerhard Stuber's first year. What do you make of where that project stands right now and this ability for them to push for the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, this came out of nowhere because they were dead in the water. But Stuber eventually, you know, found sort of the right combination of players.
Inter Miami.
Omer Fernandez has played a big role in this. Recently, Frankie Amaya has gotten onto the pitch. Getting Andrew Groupman healthy again has been huge. He has been really, really good for them this year when he has played. And then the other part is Klimala has started looking like a DP center forward. He really struggled upon arrival, which at this point we should all expect, unless it's a Zlatan level player, you should expect some struggle upon arrival. But he's been very good recently, and I think the fact that it's much more of a 4-2-3-1 than the old 4-2-2-2. So I think having guys who are like kind of wingers underneath him or out wide sometimes has given him a little bit more room to operate, and he's finding better spots, and it's working, it's clicking, and it's also hard to. I mean, it's hard in two ways, right? Because the Red Bulls play a different style of soccer than anybody else in the league. And now that they're using all these guys who haven't played all year, they have the energy to keep playing that style. That's one. And two is it's hard to get tape on them because they just changed their formation and they just changed their personnel. So it's hard to go through all of it and figure out how you want to attack it. And I mean, give Schreiber a ton of credit because it's working right now, and it's got them back in the playoff race. They are, as you said, they are 3 points back. 3 points back. So they're on 37 points. The Crew are on 34. Atlanta's on 39. Montreal, NYCFC, and DC are all on 40. The Red Bulls' next five games are home against NYCFC, at the Crew, at DC United, home against Montreal, and at Atlanta. Those
control
five teams
own,
right around
your
there.
Own destiny.
Like they, wow. Everything from here, like Schreiber said it last week, like every game we play is a cup final. Like they have to keep living that, man, because if they do, they will get into the playoffs. And it looked like a month ago there was no chance of that happening.
The most What's impressive the Red Bull thing streak to me is I think the last
for playoffs
the 12. Last six game
12
yeah so 12. It's this would be 12 if they made okay. it. So the Sounders started in 2009, the yeah. Red Bulls in 2010.
The Sounders have made a little more comfortable. this one's right on the edge.
Well, in fairness, the years it was uncomfortable for the Sounders, they won MLS Cup. So maybe that's
true.
The secret.
Yeah, maybe that's
the
secret.
New York
secret,
Red Bulls
yeah.
are going for. Yeah. Throw that supporter shield thing in the water. But the Red Bulls, I think the last six games, they haven't given up more than a goal. And for a yeah. team that lost all their center backs pretty much and has played Tom Edwards in there and Gutman and Duncan and whatever, and credit to Sean Nealis, I think, who's been very good as well over the last few weeks. A big one for them. Phil Neville had some comments that – I don't think we even have the time to get into, so maybe we'll reserve that for later on. Phil Neville's very unhappy with what he feels like is the treatment for Inter Miami. Either way, I think Gonzalo Higuain pretty unhappy, as well as Sean Davis took his ankles as well as his soul and moved on through the streets of Newark, New Jersey. I want to hit one more, the big MLS game, FC Cincinnati losing to the Philadelphia Union. Some would say the Bethlehem Steel, whichever one it was out there. The young kids are filled up.
Oh, right. Okay,
that's yeah. the point, Doyle. It clinches a spot out of the playoffs for Cincinnati. So 3 years, no playoffs. And obviously the big story over the last week is Chris Albright leaving as assistant GM of Philadelphia Union and taking over now as the head of the soccer side at FC Cincinnati. And Kalen, when you just look at what this group is, what's happened over the 3 years, everything – what's Chris Albright's job? Like, what do you come in? What's day one? What's the directive when you think about what he can do to turn this thing around? What do you want to see early on?
Well, the bar is low just based on their performances in the past and all the changes that have been made. But the opportunity is all there. And I when you look at it, especially, I think it's a really important signing for them just because you're getting somebody with MLS experience. And it seems like for the most part, the way that Cincinnati has tried to go has been to continually search abroad, mostly. I think that includes the managers for the most part. And so I think it's important for them to get somebody with some understanding of just how this league works and that, and just how to make these types of signings. We just talked about the Seattle Sounders, or they've got Will Bruin and Shane O'Neill, and all these players that have really helped them. And it seems like when you look at those types of signings for FC Cincinnati, they've largely missed. And so I think Albright should be able to bring that in. I don't think the comparison to Philadelphia is necessarily the right one as far as the trajectory or the path forward, mainly just because I don't think the infrastructure is quite there yet for FC Cincinnati to build out that academy framework and that philosophy. I think when you look at maybe a comp, and Doyle, I'd love to get your opinion on this too. I probably put it a little bit closer towards an Orlando City, a club that came in with a big aspirations, willing to
Good
spend some
base.
Money, huge fan base, opening up a stadium, that excitement, but never quite lived up to the expectations that they sort of promised, at least for the first part. And then what they go out and they get a great manager. That's why I think the next coach will be so important to do, mainly to set a culture, because that's right now, I think, what is most missing at FC Cincinnati. Oscar Pereira has come into Orlando and really, yes, they've got Nani, they've go out and spent some money, and they've made some good signings within the league and outside as well. But it's really that cultural piece that is like the building block for what's happened there. And so I think that's a pretty good comp or model if you look at what FC Cincinnati might try and do next.
Yeah, I agree across the board. And just like Orlando, FC Cincinnati is going to have a lot of high draft picks that they can hit on, and then they need to start getting that right. And once they get young players, be it via the draft or the Young Money Initiative or, you know, any other acquisition mechanism, once they get young players through the door, they have to do a better job of having a structure in place at the club to get improvement from those players. Because if you look at it now through 3 years, I can't think of a single player who was better by their second or third year in Cincinnati than they were in their first.
Agreed. And can I just do this? Because obviously there's a pretty extensive piece in ESPN about Jeff Birding and talking about what's happened so far. And one of the comments was about him trading $200,000 allocation for all of the Philadelphia Union draft picks their first year. And I actually went back and looked at the draft. And while you could say that was a mistake, they could have had Chase Gasper, Kamal Miller, Amar Sadich, and Hassani Duff. Look,
they have Ben Lunt. Ben Lunt was the best keeper in USL for two straight years, right? And they've had him since 2019, and he has not played a single MLS minute. Meanwhile, they have given every minute this year to Kenneth Vermeer and Shremslav Tita, who combined make seven figures and take up two international roster slots. That's insanity. It is the worst built roster I have ever, like, I, that's how you win three straight wooden spoons, which they're probably going to do. So, I mean, that is it. Culture is, you know, valuing your players and giving them a sort of a next man up mentality. And here's your chance. You have to take it. But making sure that they actually get that chance, that there are no sacred cows in the locker room or on the field. And that has all been missing from Cincinnati for 3 years. The biggest job for Chris Albright is to change that. I hope he gets time because it's not going to, like, the way Cincy is, it's not going to be able to happen overnight. This is like, remember when Oscar Pareja came there, the groundwork had already been laid by Musi. So like that is like, don't think of him as don't think of Chris Albright as like the Oscar Pareja in the situation. He is the GM working behind the scenes to sort of clear everything out and build anew. And that a new part is going to come, I mean, I think 2023 at the earliest.
Everyone's obviously talking about Pat Noonan, but is he the Oscar Pareja, or is there another guy out there who's, obviously, Oscar was unique. He'd won Supporters Shield. He's a winner in this league. He understands this league, and he was available because of going down to Tijuana. Is there anyone like that out there right now?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, cool.
But you know, guys lose jobs all the time, so maybe sure. You know, like it could.
LAFC sitting outside of a playoff spot. Bob Bradley might be available, although there are quite a lot of openings in Major League Soccer for him to peruse around as he goes along. Well, that's it for us. It was fun to be with you guys for this one. U.S., of course, 1-0 loss down in Panama. They will return on Wednesday. Canada against Panama on Wednesday night. That one's 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. I couldn't find the time before. Now I have found it. Now I know it. And we will be back pregame with your Twitter Spaces pregame show the moment the USMNT lineup drops. And then we'll get the Canada lineup as we're doing that show. And then we'll be back postgame with our live show. It'll double as well as our podcast, which means we'll hit all of the weekend action coming up in MLS the following weekend, because kind of as we just went through, it's not an abstract anymore. We're talking 5-6 games for teams in the playoff race, and everyone is in it, and so everyone is playing against each other. And so just as this World Cup qualifying cycle feels like it's a dogfight, I think that's what it's going to feel like coming down the stretch in MLS. I'm very excited for that. I can see Kalen's ready for a dogfight. He's big fighter mentality.
I'm ready. No, I've sweat had enough equity of that in men's league lately. I'm good.
Oh, man. And on that note, thanks so much for joining us, everyone, and have a great night.